Martin Breast, and it's an early Saturday morning in Santa Monica. And I've been asked to take a look at this movie that I did 150 years ago. And I'm as shocked as I'm capable of being as I watch these credits come up. It is a journey. Oh, man. I'll try and do my best here. Wow, I've just seen these names come up. At the end of shooting, we went to Detroit to shoot some of the chase sequence, the part that didn't involve the principal actors, and we shot this opening title sequence after we finished with all the chase stuff. This guy was actually describing the trucks in the truck chase to one of his buddies, I found out, when we went up to him to get clearance. We were shooting all these shots out of a unmarked van, like surveillance footage. We drive around and stick the camera through in between some curtains, and we shot all this footage, and we had to go get clearance. And I remember we had an off-duty policeman with us. And there was one shot of some kids spitting milk that was in a really rough housing project, and after I shot I was operating the camera for this opening sequence. This shot here of the kid spitting milk, I went in to get clearance from their parents to use it in the movie, and the off-duty cop who was accompanying us in the van would not come out into that housing project with me. He said, if you want to go, you can go. I ain't going in there. And I went in there, knocked on the door, and found the mother and got clearance to use the shot. Now, a lot of this, that's unusual, but ironically, this sequence here, right in the back of the truck, was the first day of shooting. It's unusual for the opening of a movie to be in the first day of shooting. This was the first shot we shot of Eddie in the movie, as it turns out.
I've been here too long. Talk to me.
Just give us a minute, okay?
No, I ain't got no more.
And I think we knew that we were going to have a lot of fun with them once we started this.
You know what this is? This is a federal tax stamp. You can't beat that. You can't get no cleaner than that. Talk to me. Tell me something.
So why don't you keep going into business yourself if this is such a great fucking deal?
I would, man, but I ain't from Detroit, you know, and I don't know nobody in town that can handle a job this big, but y'all supposed to got all the connections, you know? But tell me something. Shit, I'm a businessman. I'm going to sit down and do what you want to do.
You're right. It ain't easy to get rid of this shit.
I know, but see, I'm a businessman, you know? This is my thing. I'm doing business here.
Now, what with the truck? Let's get this fuck out of here.
There you go. That's what I'm talking about. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Cousin, my man, don't dash yet. This looks like $2,000 to me. This looks like $5,000.
Kimmy, let me see.
The deal is for $5,000. That's about $2,000 that
you
count yourself.
You don't want this pisses me off. I told my people it's supposed to be $5,000.
Actually, this little interchange was inspired by a little bit between De Niro and Harvey Keitel in Mean Streets.
Tell you what, let's not fucking hassle about it now. Take the $2,000, and on the next score, I promise I'll make it up to you.
Hey, look, man, don't jerk me off, all right, man? Jerk somebody else off. This is bullshit. I need $5,000, not $2,000 thing, man. Don't do this to me.
Look, don't be unreasonable. You're not dealing with Johnny Bananas. Come on.
Yeah. No, I know I ain't dealing with Johnny Bananas, but can I have my mic? No, look, can I say it slow?
I don't know if this qualifies as commentary, but I'm just sort of getting hypnotized by watching this here. So again, all this, as I recall, was the first day of shooting, and the chase that's about to start was a combination of stuff that was done in Los Angeles and in Detroit. All the stuff with the principal actors was done in Los Angeles.
Just stop, man. Just stop. You got some jumper cable, would you give me a jump?
And the whole idea of shooting second unit truck stuff in Detroit to get the real feel of Detroit, and get real sort of urban environments was something the studio held over our head throughout the shooting. If we went over budget, we wouldn't be able to go to Detroit to shoot this chase you're about to see. So this is all Los Angeles right now, but we're about to start intercutting between Los Angeles and Detroit. This was a very nerve-wracking, some of the stuff is obviously stunt guys, but a lot of it is Eddie. I mean, the stuff that, you know, you that's Eddie. And here's this. This is kind of hairy to shoot. We shot all the shots of Eddie in downtown Los Angeles, kind of just running through red lights with a police car in front of us clearing the way, and I was in the camera car behind Eddie warning him on my megaphone to be alerted for turns that were coming up so he could hold on tighter. That was a stuntman, and after he did that, he didn't really want to go back on that truck again. We called this truck the Train for obvious reasons. It was a double trailer truck, and the front bumper, that's a stuntman, of course. The front bumper of the truck was a steel I-beam, so it could go through anything without impairing the truck's ability to drive. Like that, for instance. Oh, man. That's me up on the roof up there. I think I was wearing a yellow jacket in that last shot. There's Eddie in a real truck. This is Detroit. This was the shot that guy was describing in the street earlier on. He was describing the movement of the truck. So, again, we shot all this wide stuff in Detroit, but the tight stuff of the actors in L.A. Now, coming up on this, there's this scene where the truck comes rolling down the street, and there's an amazing bit of great stuntsmanship. Gary McLarty, our stunt driver, who drove this bus, incidentally, also was driving the truck, and one of the cars that he hit was not supposed to, but did break loose from its tied down. This car here, this station wagon, almost wrapped under the car. He whips it out of the way, makes sure he gets it out from under the car and continues on. It was a pretty amazing piece of driving. When I woke up the morning we were going to shoot that straight, I woke up with a heavy heart because it was probably the most dangerous day I've ever been involved in. And I was really concerned about getting through the day with everybody being okay. And we did. I was glad to have it behind me.
Freeze, asshole!
This gentleman here coming up was a local cop we just plucked out of the chorus line there.
Holy, we should have known.
Took a number of takes to get a usable one, but he was a good sport. This was in L.A., and if I'm not mistaken, that whatever was written on that door, I remember it was misspelled, and I was in a real panic, but it was sort of in the days even before home video, and I really only was able to rest knowing that no one would ever get to really examine it, but that obviously is not true any longer. This is Paul Reiser, of course, way back when, and he and Eddie really were able to wail.
Where are you going now? I'm gonna go get my shit and get out.
I sort of had the feeling that the Detroit Police Department, as distinguished from the Beverly Hills Police Department, should be a whole different sort of species, and the idea of having Jewish cops to me seemed as sort of un-Beverly Hills as possible, so Paul seemed a perfect candidate. We named him Jeffrey, so sort of a little dig at Jeffrey Katzenberg, who was the head of the studio at the time. No, he wasn't even the head of the studio. He was, I don't know what his title was at the time. But it was our way of teasing him. Now, coming up, we have a guy named Gil Hill, who I met when I was doing research in Detroit. And Gil was the head of the homicide department in Detroit. And I saw him. Here comes Gil. And I saw him at the police department in Detroit when I was scouting locations. And there was something about him. He almost seemed to me like he could be Eddie's father, and there was something about his bearing. He had a kind of dignity that I really dug, and I asked him if he wanted to read for the part, and he did, and he was not very good, and we kept rehearsing, and he got better and better, and before too long, he was great. And I asked him if he'd come down and do it, and he had never acted before. And he came down, and he said to me, "You put a lot of faith in me, and I'm not going to let you down." And he really did it. He did a great job and had a great authenticity, and you could tell that there was something below the surface.
No more of these setups, you understand? You're a good cop. You got great potential, but you don't know every fucking thing. And I'm tired of taking the heat for your ass. One more time, you're out on the street. Do you understand me?
Boss, let me tell
you. Do you understand me?
Gil's actually running for the mayor of Detroit now. This movie sort of got him some public acclaim in Detroit, and he became councilman and then head of the city council, and now he's running for the mayor.
Go on. Go home.
I asked him after this if he did a lot of this in his job, this kind of yelling, and he said he never yelled at any officer like that, but he had been yelled at like that himself. That, I think, actually happened accidentally in a rehearsal, and we kind of weaved it into the take. That car was pretty hairy. That car, which we were scouting locations in Beverly Hills, and we stopped for coffee, the crew and myself, before production, and somebody pulled up to get coffee in a car exactly like that, and we said, "Oh my God, this is the car. This is the car he has to drive." And we tried to buy it from those people, and they wouldn't sell it, so we went out and got a couple of old ones and sort of painted it and dinged it up to match the memory of that one car that we saw. Now we're about to meet Jimmy Russo, James Russo, who I first saw in an NYU student film. He was quite extraordinary in it, and he always stuck in my mind, and he seemed like he'd, when we needed a guy for this part, you know, I wanted to use somebody that nobody had seen before, and went to Jimmy.
Look at you! Yo, man, when'd you get out?
I got out 6 months ago.
You got out 6 months ago, you're coming to see me now?
Well, they got me out a year early for, you know, a good time, and I went out to California to get some sun.
I got some sun. I should tell you a couple hours. I ain't seen you in 3 years, man. What's up? $10,000 Deutsche Marks.
Deutsche Mark? What is it?
They're bearer bonds. They're bonds. Untraceable.
You stole them?
No, it's not.
I don't want to hear it. I'm sorry I even asked. It's just good to see you, man.
Missed you, man.
Yeah.
I missed you.
Sylvester Stallone was going to be playing Eddie's part until a couple of weeks before shooting. And when we made the change, everything got thrown into the air. And all the work that had been done on the script before had to sort of essentially get thrown out.
Jenny Summers.
Jenny Summers? Oh, man, I haven't seen Jenny in years. What's she up to?
She's doing great, right? She's a manager of this art gallery, the Hollis Benton Art Gallery out in Beverly Hills. It's like a world-famous place, right? You ever hear of it?
Yeah, I buy all my art there.
A4, corner pocket, two cushion.
$50, you don't make that shot.
Bullshit.
$100.
You gotta bet. What are you gonna do, huh?
You still just as bright as you always been.
20, 40 years, 60, 80 years, take it.
I'm doing business with you.
What the fuck
are
you gonna do?
Excuse me.
Now, this scene coming up at the bar, this was quite... There was really a wonderful moment in it, where Jimmy Russo says to Eddie that he loves him as a friend, you know, as a friend, as a brother, you know. And the way it was edited made preview audiences laugh in the wrong way. I guess the sort of directness of a guy saying to another guy that he loves him kind of threw the audience a bit. And the studio wanted that cut out, and it seemed essential to me that this character had a love for Eddie and would do anything for him, and that Eddie's character knew that, and I didn't want to cut it out, but the laugh that it engendered in the audience was just show-stopping in the worst way. So we just trimmed it frame by frame, and we just got it to where it wasn't quite as... I don't remember what we did. I think we cut off the end of his shot after he says, "I love you," which I think held a little too long and made the audience uncomfortable. I think that's what we did. We just kind of adjusted it a bit, and we were able to keep it without having the audience go down the wrong pike with
it. Balance yourself. Okay? Here we go. I'm opening the door now, okay? Here we go. All right. Here we go.
Hands up! Now!
Hey, Mikey. Where have you been?
Up, Zach.
What do you got there, Mikey?
Yeah.
This is your laundry.
Here we have Jonathan Banks. Wonderful. Wonderful villain.
I came here to see my friend. I had him with me. I figured, you know...
Friend?
What are you doing?
What am I supposed to do here, Mikey?
Zach, there was a whole box full of those things there. I mean, I took a couple of them. I didn't think anybody was going to miss them. I figured I'd take them. And
shut up.
I'm sorry.
No, shut up.
Man, please.
Just shut up, Mikey. I swear, if you ever show your face out there,
I won't. I promise you, I'm sorry. I fucked up, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Now, we were rushed to get out of this location, as I recall, and we couldn't get extra coverage of Eddie falling to the ground in that little melee that preceded this. And I remember, even to this day, Eddie kind of disappears. I mean, you can see him lying on the floor in the background of this shot, but he kind of disappeared from the scene there, and it's a little unfortunate. It kind of confused some people.
Axel? I thought I told you to go to the hospital and get that bump on your head checked out.
My head is all right, man.
It's not a request, Axel.
I love Gil Hill. There's just it's really something about him that, you know, he had this quality, this sort of dignity somehow that really...
Boss.
I don't know. For whatever he didn't have an experience, he made up with... internal qualities that are just, you know, as I watch this now, even with the sound turned down, I'm just sort of impressed by his stature somehow. And there is this father-son thing that's really kind of nice.
Hey, look, we're talking about a friend of mine here. Yes, we are, aren't we? Now, let's take a close look at that. One, a hoodlum friend. Two, a professional hit. Three, in a cop's apartment. This whole thing stinks to high heaven.
How do you know it was a professional hit?
I didn't just walk into this town from the cotton fields.
Now there is, you know, the movie's sort of like this weird hybrid between In the Heat of the Night and, you know, the movie In the Heat of the Night and the Beverly Hillbillies.
I want to take my vacation now.
Stay away from this case, actually.
There's a shot coming up, the introduction to Beverly Hills, which is sort of like an obvious steal and homage to the Beverly Hillbillies.
All right.
Sort of the idea of some sort of outsider coming to the rarefied land of Beverly Hills.
It'd be the longest vacation you ever heard of.
Go a little Beverly Hillbilly action here.
I can't sit here while I go nowhere.
again, without sounding kind of goofy about it, the whole thing kind of, the thing that really interested me about the movie is sort of it echoed kind of my experience of coming out to California in a crummy car from the NYU Film School, coming out to the American Film Institute, which at that time was housed in Beverly Hills, and, you know, coming out with a buddy of mine in an old junker that barely made it across the country, and just sort of being amazed and sort of wondering how I was going to survive out in the rarefied land.
That depends. Is this hotel real expensive?
Not from Beverly Hills. Can I get your bags for you?
I remember there was whenever we screened this, there was a laugh at the end of the shot that I never could figure out. I think it had to do with this little interchange back there. Now I can see it. I never saw it because I wasn't aware of it as we were shooting, but that gentleman who, the extra there who played the doorman back there, gave Eddie a great look. It's something I didn't see until I, you know, had a little removal from the movie. Now this scene unfolding here, as a lot of the scenes in the film, we had sort of a predicament, sort of an opportunity of Eddie having to sort of con his way into a circumstance or convince something of something.
No Rolling Stone, no Axel Foley. I'm sorry, sir.
Well, that's all right. You guys probably just made some kind of mistake with reservations. Why don't you just give me another room now, go up and go to sleep?
I'm sorry, sir, but there are no rooms available.
Don't you think I realize what's going on here, miss? Who do you think I am, huh? Don't you think I know that if I was some hot shot from out of town that pulled inside here and you guys made a reservation mistake, I'd be the first one to get a room and I'd be upstairs relaxing right now. But I'm not some hot shot from out of town. I'm a small reporter from Rolling Stone magazine that's in town to do an exclusive interview.
As I said, you know, Sylvester Stallone was going to be playing this part until just before shooting. And I thought that the idea of Eddie playing the part would be magnificent, but I really wanted to stay away from any issues of race. I felt that race should not be an issue in the film. It should be more of a class thing. And there were two places where he kind of sort of, you know, played the race card, as it were, and they were just too good to resist. So I kind of broke my rule here. And we had fun with this whole Jackson thing that he does.
Fine.
And that'll be suite 1035.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Coming up, we needed a shot of Eddie walking down the street in Beverly Hills, and we couldn't fit it in our schedule, and I was begging for it, and they wouldn't let me have it. So one day during lunch, we were in downtown L.A. in a really crummy street, and we got this guy on the right here in some outfit, these two guys, which were Eddie's buddies, and we put some fancy cars down at the end of the street, put on a long lens, and put up some greenery, and it looks like Beverly Hills. This was like a really scuzzy area, believe it or not. And we were able to sort of run over there on our lunch hour and just grab that one shot because we desperately needed it. Now, I'm just laughing in anticipation of Bronson Pinchot, who was mind-bogglingly delicious in this. Every take was completely different, and every angle was completely different. The angle on Eddie was completely different than the angle on Bronson. And the fact that this was cut together to look like two people are actually talking to each other, it was a miracle of editing. It took forever. In fact, it was so chaotic looking in dailies that the studio was thinking about reshooting it, making me reshoot it. And Billy Weber cut it together really quickly. And needless to say, they asked us not to reshoot it, fortunately, because it has some of the more inspired comic acting ever.
Polly's here to see her. He's out of the Queens.
That sounds like hyperbole, and I'm sorry, but what Bronson is doing here is just off the scale.
Now, offer you something to drink.
In fact, I'm just going to turn the volume on so I can listen to it myself here.
Espresso?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
I'll make it myself right back there with a little lemon twist. It's good. Try it.
Bronson was amazing. There's some stuff that he did later on that was so funny, I had to almost excuse myself from the set because I kept ruining takes by laughing. Which happened a couple times in the movie.
Tonight to a collector.
Get the fuck out of here!
Somebody else has said it myself.
Axel Foley, what on earth are you doing here?
How you doing?
I'm fine. Hold a second. I'll be right down.
Great. Excuse me, Serge.
Bronson. He's unbelievable.
It's good to see you.
This is Lisa Eilbacher, of course.
Look at you.
You like?
Yeah.
You good?
You're getting old.
Fuck you. What is this?
Mustache.
One of the challenges she had was, in this kind of short scene, kind of create the impression that she and Eddie went way back and were friends from childhood.
Over there.
Great. I can't believe how you filled out.
Yeah.
And she filled it in kind of nicely with sort of little touches here and there that implied a history.
I'll talk to you about Mikey.
Oh, is he in trouble again?
Although, that hair. That hair. I remember we really were going around and around on her hair. And I still not quite satisfied with it there. It looks a little bit something. In any event, that's Lisa Eilbacher.
Look, I can't right now. I'll be up in a second.
Mikey mentioned that you helped him get a job.
Yeah, the guy who owns this gallery hired him. It's a favor to me.
Who's this guy?
His name is Victor Maitland. He was working for Victor at the gallery's warehouse. Look, Axel, I can't talk right now. I have to go upstairs.
Miss Cole, I'll call you later on. We'll get together later and talk, okay?
Sure.
Be good.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
I have a delivery for Victor Maitland.
Oh, I'll take it right upstairs to him.
Or maybe I should give it to him myself.
Well, deliveries are supposed to be left on my desk.
Yeah, but
now, get these flowers. It's imperative. I'm going to go up myself. Right? Trying to come up with a villain was kind of a... It was kind of rough. Something about Stephen Burkoff's power, the sort of the laser quality of his look. I think I saw a photograph of him in a paper somewhere because he was in a play as, you know, he's a writer and he's a director in addition to being an actor. Very sort of experimental and avant-garde work.
That's terrible.
It's fucked up.
But the photograph I saw of him was so potent that we thought it would be a wild way to go.
Good gracious. I'm really sorry to hear this. Would you like to sit down? Can I get you anything?
No, I'm all right.
Well, how on earth did this happen? Detroit is a very violent city, isn't it?
I remember this location, we kind of really struggled to place in this building that towered over Los Angeles, and I remember fighting to really try and get us to shoot it up there rather than another location, and they built this entire office set on this abandoned floor, this unfinished floor at the top of this building, so we'd get these great views of Los Angeles out the window. However, the day we shot... The city was just completely smogged in, so all you see is white.
To the door.
Hey, JP, yo, man, get the fuck off! Get off, man! Get off! Get the fuck off! Get off! Get the fuck off me, man! Get off! Get the fuck off! You gonna play a game, man? Hey, you fucking somebody else. Thank you.
Ouch.
Hey! Did you see this shit? I can describe all of them.
Please move to the side of the car and put your hands on the hood.
Why? What's with you guys?
You heard what he said, sir. Do it right.
Casting
now.
Beverly Hills Cop was really sort of a challenge. I kind of wanted them all to look like TV cops, you know, very different than anything we saw in the Detroit section of the film. I wanted them to all look like surfer, sort of actor cops. This gentleman is frisking Eddie. Actually showed up to the audition in a police uniform, which just seemed... It seemed like the kind of thing I wouldn't have fallen for, but it kind of worked. He just fit the bill.
Disturbing the peace.
Disturbing the peace? I got thrown out of a window. What's the fucking charge for getting pushed out of a moving car, huh? Jaywalking? This is bullshit.
You know, this is the cleanest and nicest police car I've ever been in my life. This thing's nice in my apartment. Officers, if we see any, like, movie stars, could y'all stop and point them out to me? I never seen no shit like that.
That's enough talking, pal.
Okay, that's cool.
Now, this next scene in the jail cell, that's another one I was desperate to have, but we didn't have any money to build a jail set, so I think we repainted another set that we had over and just put some bars in front of it. This one here. This is actually the last shot we filmed in the movie, as I recall. Eddie looks a little tired there. Now, we never got a chance to actually see what the Beverly Hills Police Department looked like, because they would never let us in. And I know, I'm sure this was sort of like a fantasy of what it might look like.
Have a seat right over there, please.
We knew it didn't look like this, but we just wanted to really go out on a limb there and just make it as different as possible from anything that might occur in Detroit. And here are my boys, John Ashton and Judge Reinhold. I've always been a great fan of Laurel and Hardy and The Honeymooners, and the opportunity to actually cast and put together a team that has the sort of the comedic magic of those kind of guys. And I think that these guys together do have that sort of perfect chemistry. Was a blast. John is a great actor. Judge is a great actor. And they really sort of went into this sort of... They just fit together like... Perfect. They're just perfect.
Don't square off on me with some bullshit. You want to start some static?
Hey, don't push me.
Fuck you, man.
Taggart. Yes, sir.
The great Ronnie Cox.
Sir, I apologize for striking you. I have no excuse.
Forget about it.
Detective Foley, I'm Lieutenant Bogomil of the Beverly Hills Police Department. Do you wish to file charges against Sergeant Taggart?
This is some kind of joke, right?
Yeah, you know, the whole thing in putting this together, the premise was, and again, the conception of the Beverly Hills Police Department in this comes totally from imagination. But the whole notion was that it was sort of like the private security force for rich people, as opposed to a more sort of democratic and for the people police department that might occur somewhere else. And again, back to the class issue, not to sound too pretentious here, but that was sort of like the whole kind of vibe underneath it, you know, sort of like there's the regular people and then there's these rich people who are somehow different than all of us. You know, they buy weird art and they have like their own little police department that takes care of just them and sort of out of touch with all the other aspects of life. And even though that is fantastic and not, you know, reality, that was the premise underlying.
He's my boss.
He tells me you may not be very welcome back there. He says that you're an outstanding young detective. I find that very difficult to believe.
But it's true, though.
He also says he nearly had to fire you for insubordination. I find that very easy to believe. Now, what are you doing in Beverly Hills?
I told you, I'm on vacation. I went to the bathroom. The next thing I know, six guys threw me out a window.
Inspector Todd gave me a message for you. Want to hear it?
I don't think so.
He says if you're out here investigating the Tandino murder, you needn't bother coming back. He tells me if we inform him you are working on this case, he'll have you brought up on charges and fired. Now, one last time, what are you doing?
I'm on vacation!
Vacation. Rosewood, take Mr. Foley over to the courthouse and let him arrange for bail.
Follow me, sir.
You know, I got to hand it to you guys. If anything, you are extremely...
Judge is great.
Pretty good punch you got that
time. I
got
to say, you know, Marge Simkin, who was our casting director, really brought in some amazing people. This combo is just... These guys are just perfect together. I'm so amazed. Seeing them all these years later, the chemistry is really amazing.
You know, if I'd known why you'd been arrested, I wouldn't have come.
Oh, you don't mean that.
No, I don't mean that. Axel, if it wasn't for Victor Maitland, I'd be waiting on tables.
Well, it just so happens that the day that Mikey got killed, he showed up in my apartment with a bag of German bearer bombs. Now, I think he stole them from whoever had him killed. When I mentioned Mikey's name to Maitland, that's when Maitland went nuts and had me thrown out.
Axel, you look like
Whoa.
A problem. You go barging into the office without an appointment.
That's a lot of exposition. I mean, some of these scenes, you know, there are a couple of them throughout the movie where we just had to sort of like tie all these story points together that are really a little bit less than graceful, but, you know, needless to say, the movie wasn't really about the story as much as it was about, you know, the dynamics between the characters.
Same crappy blue shabby Nova. You think it's too late for me to study art?
Yeah, I do. Axel, why were you bothering Victor? We don't think he has anything to do with Mikey getting killed, do you?
Oh, no. No, I was just poking around. I don't think he did that.
Axel, Victor Maitland is one of the top art dealers in the United States. He has been for 10 years.
Yeah, I remember being in a fevered phone call with Don Simpson, rest his soul, about the expositional requirements for this area, the story points, and how much we should jam in and how much we shouldn't jam in and which story points we should hit. And I was trying to shoot the scene, and I was on the, you know, it was the early days of mobile phones, and it was really kind of challenging to try and get off the phone so I could actually shoot something.
Believe this place?
Axel, how can you afford this?
They always charge me a single room rate.
How can you afford that?
Well, actually, I can't afford it. But you know what they got inside that bathroom? They got little robes with little initials of the hotel on it. I love this place. I can't believe this shit. I'm going to steal one of them robes. You want one of them?
No, thanks.
You want some of the slippers?
No.
I'm going to steal some of them, too. You should take some of this shit. Excuse me, 2 seconds. Hello, room service? Yes, this is Mr. Axel Foley in Suite 1035.
Now, coming up is the banana in the tailpipe, which is something that people always bring up to me. It somehow becomes sort of an iconic joke of some kind.
Salad sandwich, okay.
It was originally going to be a potato in the tailpipe. Eddie was going to sneak down to the kitchen of the hotel and get a potato, which would serve to clog the cop's tailpipe really well. However, another one of those sort of budget battles ensued, and we couldn't shoot another location. We couldn't get to another part of the hotel to light it and shoot it. We just couldn't squeeze that in. So we had to have Eddie get something from an area that we were already lit and shooting in. So we decided we would do it in the lobby of the hotel. We couldn't figure out how we'd get a potato in the lobby. So we decided we set up a little buffet and have them take a piece of fruit, a banana.
Good evening, sir.
The hell is that?
And he was going to get it from, he just was going to take it from a buffet, so we had to hire, you know, like a buffet attendant.
I need a
Eddie brought Damon Wayans in, who was at the... Here he is.
Peaches, plums, oranges, and bananas.
Well, all I need is a couple of bananas.
Take those bananas.
Thanks. Forget it. I'm not eating that. Take it back.
Certainly, sir.
This really looks great.
Can I get some extra mayo?
Certainly, sir.
Thank you.
Ready to go?
Yeah.
There's the Mercedes. Will you get rid of that stuff?
I remember asking Judge see if he could make a car act. I said, Judge, can you make this car look like it's stalling out using the... He did a great job.
This the place?
Yeah, but I'm still not sure I should do this.
Okay, you don't have to do anything. But when you hear glass and shit breaking, don't get scared. It's just me kicking in the window. Sit tight.
All right, come on, asshole.
And now Harold Faltermeyer, who did the score, did an amazing job of... this is sort of early on in the history of sort of synthesized musical scores. And what was really extraordinary, since the movie was done on a very, very tight schedule, is his ability to create something and rework it to picture. So we could come in at night and see some cues that he did and rework them and rework them, you know, while we were right there, and just sort of alter the whole cue.
You find something?
Coffee grounds.
Because we didn't have a lot of time to sort of pre-plan it. So it was sort of like created and revised and revised and revised on the spot. And it was a really wonderful ability to be able to sort of customize the score like that, sort of tune in each piece of music rather than just sort of get it and stick it in. This gentleman here carrying the box... The older gentleman is Chuck Adamson, who is one of the great Chicago organized crime cops, who, just as we were shooting this, became a writer and a television producer and produced a whole bunch of his memories of working organized crime.
I didn't know if you was trying to pick a make on me or what, so I thought I'd take you over there tonight. Let him have a little shot at you before I tore his head off. Come on, let's go. I want to get out of here. Just get off my back. Come on. I got it.
Come on. Hurry up.
Hurry up.
Give me the key. I'm going to follow.
Have you ever driven Mercedes before?
No, but a car is a car. I drive my car every day.
I'm driving. I've seen your car.
Oh, shit. That's cold.
A banana in your tailpipe? How could you not notice a man sticking a banana in your tailpipe?
Well, he distracted us, sir.
And how'd he do that?
Well, he sent us a late supper, sir. See, this waiter comes over.
Billy, he gets the point.
A late supper. And what did you have, Rosewood?
I think it was a shrimp salad sandwich, sir.
A shrimp salad sandwich?
Yes, sir.
I want you two to go back to the hotel and wait for Foley to show up. And if you lose him again, don't bother calling in. You got that?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. A late supper.
we've got something for you, Billy. An anti-banana disguise. It may come in handy.
A little extra protection, Billy.
Very funny. Come on, Billy. Let's go.
Why don't you take the car and go on home?
Well, what about you?
I want to find out what this place is.
Oh, I can tell you that. It's a bonded warehouse. They hold our foreign shipments here till they clear customs.
Well, I'm going to go check it out.
Ah, okay? That's what a bonded warehouse is. Yeah, as I said, we had to jam story points in wherever we could. It was sort of a little slapdash. So this scene, Eddie was just going to steal a forklift and ride it up to that. He was going to climb over this. As he climbed over it, we didn't even know we were going to have another scene following it. He was just going to steal this forklift and head over and get the box, pretending he was a worker.
Hi, do you have a match?
No smoking in here.
I'm not going to smoke now. I'm going to smoke when I go outside. Thank you very much. Thank you. Is your supervisor here?
Yeah, he's in the office.
Can you go get him for me, please?
What's the problem?
Are you security here?
Yeah.
Then you're the fucking problem. Go get your supervisor, please. Now! Now!
Okay.
Well. He didn't come back yet.
What do we do now?
We wait.
Okay.
Can I help you?
Are you the supervisor here?
Yes, who are you?
I'm Inspector Ratt for the United States Customs Service.
Has all this stuff passed through customs already?
This
no,
scene
this
was
well, then tell me something. Answer a question.
The other scene that had a racial reference that I just couldn't resist letting go by, even though that wasn't going to be part of the thing.
I don't know. Well, thank you. That's the answer I was looking for. Why don't you guys just give me your ID number, because somebody's going to lose their job behind this. This guy gave me a match, for Christ's sake.
You gave him a match?
Listen to me. I
can't tell you how invigorating it is and horrifying to be setting up a scene and not know, like, exactly how it's going to sort of work out.
The background of each and every crate in this section, starting with this one right here.
Wow. You know, it says here that by the time the average American is 50, he's got 5 pounds of undigested red meat in his bowels.
Why are you telling me this? What makes you think I have any interest in that at all?
Well, you eat a lot of red meat.
Now, the inspector needs all the information on those airway bill numbers.
And all the manifests, too.
That's right, and he needs the records of all shipments due into the same destination.
Right. What's this all about?
Just do it.
You got some kind of warrant for this?
You know, you have a very big mouth, sir.
Now, needless to say, this scene
is that what you're doing?
Was shot right after the previous scene with Rick Overton in it, because, you know, we knew that we were going to have some scene in the filing office where he was going to get some papers to track down whatever. I don't even remember what it is now.
I want you to know something, pal, and I want all of y'all to know something. I can have 25 agents down here in 15 minutes to march in here, snatch your bond from underneath you, and you guys will be out of business permanently if I don't get some cooperation. Is that understood?
Don't get upset, Inspector. We'll give you everything you need. Right, guys? Everything you need.
That's not my Porsche, no, sir. I don't know whose it is.
Well, you ain't got nothing to worry about then. I don't know what y'all think I am. Keep you some kind of fool. Hurry up, quicker.
I've always loved that cut from Eddie to these two guys sitting there waiting.
A lot of coffee lately. Well, I think that's why you have a hard time.
Needless to say. An homage. homage to Laurel and Hardy.
Jesus Christ.
He almost gave me a heart attack.
What are you guys doing here so late?
You're a cocky son of a bitch, aren't you?
Look, man, if you're still mad about the banana thing, I'm sorry, all right? I just need a little time to myself. I just wish I would have saw the expression on your face when the car conked in.
Yeah, very funny. Lieutenant Doctor's 2 days' pay.
Get out of here. He's not kidding.
No, he's not kidding.
By the way, thanks for the sandwich.
He meant it as a joke, Billy, like the bananas.
Hey, wait a minute. I'm a fellow police officer. I know what it's like to be in a stakeout. When I send that food down to you guys, that was from the heart.
Bullshit.
Why are we always arguing, man? Look, all three of us are cops. We should be working together. We all had a very rough day today. What do you say? We all go get something to drink and make up and be friends, huh?
Forget it.
Okay, fuck it. I'm going to go get something to drink, though, all right?
Part of the development of the story was that was, as far as I was concerned, I'm sure as far as everybody was concerned, was sort of the real critical part of the development, the sort of bringing together of the two disparate schools of police work, you know, the guys who don't get along, guys who have different ways of doing it, sort of kind of uniting based upon a common commonality, common something, I don't know. Now, this young lady, whose professional name was Mouse, was sort of like a legendary stripper. And this song she used in her act, and it was just really, just sort of had a perfect vibe to it, so we used it in the film.
Hi, can I get you something?
Yeah, it's all, I'm having a great time. Can I have a scotch and soda? And the brothers, what you want, like light beers for the fellas?
Two club sodas.
Yo, crack me up, man, with this on-duty shit. Billy, you know, you don't have to be embarrassed if your dick gets hard. But your dick is supposed to get hard, see? That's the whole object of this. Taggart's dick is hard, but he won't let you know because he's a boss. The boss dick got to stay limp, right? Yeah, I ain't on duty, so my dick can be hard.
Now, the morning that I went to shoot this, because we had a very little amount of time to shoot this scene, I remember I watched 48 hours. That morning, I mean, I kept watching certain scenes over and over again because there was something about Walter Hill's bar scenes and strip bar scenes and something about it that just seemed like this should have that kind of a vibe.
Yeah, so you guys don't know nothing about nothing, do you? You just got your badges and your guns and you're on the job, right? Make sure we get the right drinks because if I drink club soda, I'll throw up. Thank you so much. Thank you very much.
Guys are sort of like, it's like In Cold Blood. They always reminded me of those guys from In Cold Blood.
Think she likes you?
Think so?
No doubt in my mind.
I remember really being nervous about doing this scene because it was so contingent upon people looking at things and what their thoughts are about things. You know, Eddie looking at one guy and then looking back at Taggart and then looking to the other guy. It was all about looks and perceptions of what people are seeing. And I remember being very alarmed at making sure it was shot in a way where all that was really clear. A lot of looks in this scene. Everybody's looking at it. It's like a little look concerto.
Sit tight, Billy.
Wonderfully edited. I remember using all my all the books I read in film school about screen direction and who's on what side of the room and which way you should look to have a look tie into such and such, all that kind of stuff. Kind of like drawing on all of that to make sure we always knew where everybody was and who everybody was looking at, even though they were in far parts of the room.
About that. It's Phil. It is Phil. I told you it's Philip, you liar. Hey, Philip, give me a kiss, baby.
Give me a kiss, baby. That's delicious.
Everybody freeze.
Turn around.
Phil.
Get your hands on the table.
Phil. What's wrong, man? What's all the hostility, Phil?
Get back, man.
What you doing with all this gun, man?
Okay, get back.
You changed, man.
Don't get back. I'm going to blow your fucking brains out.
Please, move and I'll kill you.
Don't move! Turn over!
Way to go, Rosewood. You're some kind of cop, you know that?
Sorry for the disturbance, folks.
When we shot this next thing coming up right here, when Eddie did it, I thought, oh my God, I shot the poster today. I just felt like that was going to be the image of the movie. It wasn't the poster, as it turns out. But it was an image that was sort of remembered. Now, this scene was hysterical because there was no oxygen in this set. The roof was closed. And there was no way to get air in it. And it was in August or something like that. Or July, and there was no air. And everybody's getting really sluggish. And Eddie, who had never had a cup of coffee in his life practically, finally decided he was going to have a cup of coffee. Because he was just dragging, and he had a cup of coffee, and it sent him through the roof. And in this scene, he's like zapped. He's like flying high on a caffeine experience, the likes of which he's never had. And he was so hilarious in this scene that I had to go into one of those offices. I kept blowing the takes because I was laughing so hard. I finally had to go back into one of these glass rooms behind the camera and listen to the scene with earphones, and even John Ashton's laughing there. Even through the room, they heard me laughing, so they had to cover me with moving blankets. So I actually didn't even see Eddie do this scene. I was under moving blankets, laughing my head off with headsets on.
Foley invited us to this bar. We accepted.
We ordered club sodas, sir.
Right. And while we were there, Foley observed the two suspects casing the establishment. And before we knew what was going on, he'd already disarmed one of them. Detective Foley deserves all the credit for the arrest, sir.
Detective Foley, we appreciate your assistance. But in the future, if you want to practice law enforcement, I would prefer you did it in Detroit. I understand, sir. I'm sorry. But before I go, I just want you two to know something, all right? That the super cop story was working. Okay? It was working, and you guys just messed it up. Okay? I'm trying to figure you guys out, but I haven't yet. But it's cool. It's a fuck-up, perfectly good lie, and it's all right.
Eddie was on fire that day.
You guys are off the case. Foster, McCabe, your turn. Don't lose him.
Not a chance, sir.
And you two? In my office.
Morning, gentlemen. Some coffee and donuts?
I love these two guys. They seem just the perfect, in retrospect, they do seem like the perfect sort of second tier of a Beverly Hills Police Department. Sort of ambitious and perfectly despicable.
Morning, officers. What y'all
now, in this scene, this is a little strange, but the idea of having two African-American actors of different socioeconomical backgrounds seemed like something worth having fun with. And I told Eddie at the beginning of the scene that I thought that maybe it was sort of mineable, that maybe we could sort of have fun with this notion of the two classes, you know, one race but two classes. And he kind of was a little confused by it, and I kind of, you know, laid it out a little clearer, and then he wailed with it. He really did exactly what I would have hoped.
Y'all want something to drink? Beer or something? I got some stuff in the trunk. Excuse me.
Now, this mansion, Victor Maitland's mansion, and the ensuing streets, was not shot in Beverly Hills. We found that at the time, Beverly Hills, I don't know how it is now, was extremely unmovie friendly. And when we shot that scene on Rodeo Drive when Eddie first enters Beverly Hills, we had to actually shoot that, I think, between like 7:30 in the morning and 8 o'clock in the morning. So literally some narrow band of unusable time. And for things like this, we found that it was impossible to even consider shooting in Beverly Hills. So we found this mansion in I believe it was in Santa Monica Canyon. It's still there, I think. Of course it's still there. It's a mansion. These streets also coming up were not shot in Beverly Hills. Nothing really was shot in Beverly Hills. Nothing much. Now, in the days before video assist in shooting, it's really hard to sort of see what an actor is doing if you have a car mount, like what's about to come up. Eddie driving away, you know, the camera is mounted on the car. So I was sort of sitting in the bottom of the passenger well. In a shot like this, for instance, I was sort of like down on the floor.
All this shit happened last time I parked here. Thank you.
I'm looking for Victor Maitland.
You realize that this is a members-only club?
Mm-hmm, but I have to talk to Victor. It's very, very important.
Are you sure it's Victor Maitland you want?
Oh, yes, Victor Maitland, the gray-haired gentleman, very dark-skinned, Capricorn, Victor.
Well, why don't you give me the message, and I'll take it to him.
Okay, I guess I can do that. Tell Victor that Ramon, the fella he met about a week ago, tell him that Ramon went to the clinic today and I found out that I have herpes simplex 10. And I think Victor should go check himself out with his physician to make sure everything is fine before things start falling off on the man.
Perhaps you better tell him that.
You know, I think that would be best.
So do I.
We had a lot of flies that day. They really loved that buffet. And we had to spray it down. Every little piece of cake and every little... Everything was covered in, like, bug poison. We had to keep spraying it down. Had to make sure that we had, like, a clean thing of cherries or whatever it was for Eddie to munch on.
Look, guys, don't even try it, okay?
Why don't you get the hell out of here, cuz?
Get the fuck away from me, man.
Thank you.
That's very good, Victor. Could you, like, teach him to roll over and sit and do all that shit, too?
What do you want?
I want to talk to you.
This scene coming up here, you know, it was really great in this movie because a lot of the actors were more than actors. Eddie obviously is more than an actor. He's, you know, he's directed, he's a writer, he's a comedian. Stephen Berkoff here is an actor, but he's also a writer and director.
You know, Victor, I know that you're into a lot of crooked shit, and I have a pretty good idea that you had Mikey killed. And when I find out for sure, I'm gonna fuck you up real bad.
Is that so? Now listen to me, my tough little friend. I don't know from under what stone you crawled, or where you get these ridiculous ideas about me. But it seems painfully obvious you haven't the slightest fucking idea who you're dealing with. Now, my advice to you is, crawl back to your little stone in Detroit.
What a puss. What a great puss Stephen Berkoff has. Look at that face.
Please step away from the table, sir.
Now, these are the brunette Beverly Hills cops. We didn't want it to be too redundant, so these are the little brunette brothers. I remember one guy was blonde. I think the guy in the, this guy here, and I think we had to put a toupee on him like that morning because I didn't want it to look like the same cops that busted Eddie in the earlier scene. Back in the Beverly Hills Police Department set. Now, it's hard to see from this angle, but the whole notion behind this set, which we had to sort of whip up on very short notice, was based on a set that I and the production designer of this movie developed for a movie called War Games, which unfortunately I was fired off of. But we had spent a very long time designing this gigantic set. It was one of the biggest sets done ever at the time, and it was this hugely complicated set for NORAD, Mission Control, the Air Force. And
everybody knows that Victor Maitland is a hotshot art deal, okay? But I did some poking around, and art's not...
We had done so much research and so much theoretical discussion of it, and it was and built it, although I never got a chance to shoot on it, that when it came time to do this set, which was a significant... We had a significantly smaller budget. We kind of used the same ideas that we took a while to develop for the other set, which is essentially having a staging area, this office area where they are now, that overlooks a control room. And even though the control room area with its screens and monitors and buttons and whatnot cost 50 times more than this room, and even though we hardly played any other action in that room, it always served as a background. And we kind of used the same layout as we did in War Games because... But I found coffee grounds all over the warehouse. It was nice to finally get a chance to use some of those ideas. But as I said, in these angles, you can't really appreciate it. It's sort of the reverse angles where you see into the room itself. You get more of a sense of that.
Detective Foley, I'm sorry.
Now, these lines that Ronnie Cox is saying here, I'm sure he was given those probably... a half hour before we shot this or something. It was really, we were really winging it around here because this is where the whole story had to sort of come together. All the loose story points had to start to knit here. And I know this was done like 2 seconds before we shot. In fact, Stephen Elliott, who played the chief of police, who's about to enter, is holding a piece of paper in his hands, and that is his script pages, which he was sort of like reading, you know, just before he went on. And in the rehearsals, he had it in his hand, and it just seemed like a good piece. But yes, ladies and gentlemen, that piece of paper he's holding is his script, his pages for the day. And Stephen, I met years ago in an audition for another movie. He was auditioning for another part, and the audition wasn't going well. He was reading lines with the casting director in a scene, and she wasn't an actor, and he kind of railed at reading lines with a non-actor, and he stopped the audition and screamed at both of us and scared the hell out of us. And he walked out of the audition, and it was so impressive. He scared me so much. I thought, this is the guy we got to get for the chief, because the chief has to just come on for a tiny scene, and he really has to be extraordinarily intimidating. And I remember that horrible experience, but this is the guy.
There's the man who wrecked the buffet at the Harrow Club this morning.
Lower your voice, for Christ's sake.
What, can a guy hear me through the wall?
Yes, he can.
And also that thing that he did, he said, is this the man that blah, blah, blah with Taggart and Rosemont instead of saying Taggart and Rosewood? That was an accident he did in rehearsals. And I remember the dolly grip, the guy pushing the dolly, looked at me when we were shooting and he said, we should keep it. That was pretty funny. So I said, yeah, good idea. Let's keep it. And we asked Stephen to keep it.
When you get there, you can give him his gun back. The two charges of disturbing the peace have been dropped against you. But the chief says if you return to the city of Beverly Hills, the charges will be reinstated and you will be prosecuted to the limit of the law.
Sir, may I say something?
Billy.
What?
Well, he seems to have enough to follow.
You want to tell that to the chief?
We knew that this scene was going to tie everything together in some way. And that people were going to be angry at everybody. We kind of had the general vibe of what was going on, but not the specifics. And if you listen closely, you'll see it's deliciously vague about what the nature of the conflicts were. Oh, not this scene, but the next scene with the judge and Eddie outside the police department.
Right. Let me check on that tomorrow and get right back to you.
Now, this scene, the studio wanted to cut out of the movie. Because they felt the movie was too long. But without this scene, the whole sort of impetus for Eddie to want to really get into the mansion and save Lisa Eilbacher at the end was completely shot. But this scene really established the villainy of the Stephen Berkoff character. And I really wanted it in. So I wound up trading the scene for a freeze frame at the end of the movie. When Eddie's last line in the movie, there's a freeze frame, which I thought was a little tacky, but I kind of negotiated, okay, we'll do the freeze frame, but let me keep this scene in. So that was directorial negotiations 101.
Yes. Yes, I know. And then?
Well, that's it. He left and, I haven't seen him since.
Jenny, darling, you wouldn't by any chance know where Foley is staying, would you? I have some information which just might be helpful for him.
No, I have no idea.
Yes. 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 Oh, I hope I didn't disturb you too much.
No, no problem.
We'll have dinner soon, yes?
Well, that'd be lovely.
Take care.
Now, here comes a scene I was telling you about between Judge and Eddie outside the police department.
Never mind, Bogomil. This is a chance for me and you to blow this case wide open to two of us. What do you say?
Come on. I mean, as you watch the movie, it seems like it's... Of course, yes, this makes perfect sense for what transpired in the previous scene. But believe me when I tell you, we had no idea what was going on. It's just like perfectly right on the edge of vagary.
It'll just take a couple of minutes. My friend Jenny will let us in Maitland's warehouse. We can be there when the shipment comes in and nail him.
How can you be sure if it'll be drugs or something?
I got a hunch, okay? That's a technique by which many crimes outside of Beverly Hills get solved.
Why didn't you tell Bogomil about this shipment?
Bogomil does everything by the book. You know, I'm starting to think that everybody in this goddamn town is a robot. This thing is very personal to me.
All he asked me to do was drive you out of town. Now I'm going to screw that up, too.
Billy, I love you. I just fell in love with you.
Now, this scene was the first scene that was shot with Bronson. And again, in this scene, I was just... I didn't know how Bronson's character was exactly going to unfold. But when he said this line here...
You want to be the lineman twist?
Yeah, sure, if it's no bother.
No, don't be stupid.
And when he said that line, I was biting through pencils to keep from laughing because there's no place I could hide, and I ruined many, 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 many takes. But it was just the beginning because he was just unreal.
Look, Axel, if this has anything to do with Mikey getting killed, then I want to go check it out for myself.
I don't have time to stand here and argue with you, Jenny.
Wait a second. Let me get my keys, and we'll argue on the way.
Okay, Billy, your job is just sit out here and observe things.
I remember trying to find that building. It was really hard, wondering what a warehouse would look like in Beverly Hills. And we all know, like, warehouses can be kind of old and depressing, but we wanted a chic warehouse, and they found this building wasn't even in L.A., but, I mean, it wasn't even in Beverly Hills, but it really had, looked like a Beverly Hills warehouse somehow.
Okay? Thank you. Is there any chance that you're going to give me that key and let me go in there by myself right now?
No, dear.
Fuck. Come on.
Favorite cues in the movie, this piece of music. It was a very elaborate piece of music, way too elaborate for the moment. And we wound up clicking off all the different tracks to just reveal sort of like this rhythm track that was left, and that's all we kept.
Well, it looks like they've been here already.
What exactly are you looking for?
This. This is a crate from overseas, hasn't passed through customs yet.
Just sort of like amazing that even though the plot is very sort of tinny, it does amaze me that it does kind of stick together, that it's remotely coherent, and that the concerns of all the characters kind of tie together is boggles my mind. Now, this scene has one of my favorite shots of Steven Berkoff in it. He says something to Eddie's character, and Eddie's character said, when we shot it over Eddie's back looking at Steven Berkoff, Eddie's character improvised something. Eddie improvised something, rather. And it didn't quite fit the scene. So we cut out Eddie's dialogue, but kept Steven's reaction. And it's a brilliant reaction, but it's really based upon him hearing something. But when the dialogue was yanked out that he was responding to, it became even more interesting. As you watch it, you can really sense. I'll show you where it comes
from. Shut
up!
I don't want to
hear. I think it's coming right up now. Yeah, here it comes. Yeah, he was actually responding to something that Eddie said, which we yanked, and without Eddie's dialogue, it just became the most interesting, bizarre, kind of scary reaction. So, still had validity. Yeah, maybe even more so.
Yeah, Jenny, don't worry about me. We got cocaine and coffee here. We're going to get wired and have a big party. Thanks for having me over, Vic. This is very nice.
This was, I think, the second time I worked with Angelo Graham, the production designer. And it was really fortunate we had a shorthand because, you know, we had to sort of whip stuff up at the last minute. Everything was, you know, not to be redundant, but improvisational. And we didn't have a lot of time to talk about sets. And everything came together very quickly. It was good having somebody I worked with before.
Really? That would be a neat trick.
I've worked, since worked with Angelo on a number of other movies, I adore him. It's not his fault that I asked for a warehouse location.
Are you still pissed at me?
No. But I should have taken care of you in Detroit. When I popped your little buddy.
Goodbye, Mr. Foley.
What is it about villains and warehouse locations?
I'll try.
There's always a villain in a warehouse. An empty warehouse in movies, isn't there? Remember this area when we were, once Eddie got on board to do the movie and we kind of changed everything, this area was a sort of the thing that I was really aiming towards in the restructuring of the movie. This whole notion that the unorthodox policing techniques that Eddie's character used wound up wearing off on the most orthodox Beverly Hills cops, and they actually kind of started to use his technique of following their instincts, bending little rules if that was required, and the idea of Judge, who was playing a real by the books kind of kid, would actually sort of use some of that technique. It was almost like a victorious turnaround for the Beverly Hills cops, followed by John Ashton's in the scene coming up. Coming up in a couple of scenes, that was sort of like that was one of the most important structural dynamics we tried to go after, the sort of infection of Eddie's style onto the uptight BH cops.
Tell Packers to check out the warehouse at that address and act on whatever he finds. I'll explain it to him later.
DD6, Sergeant Tigard is here now. He wants to talk to you.
Shit!
Billy, what the hell is going on?
I'm sorry, Sarge, I can't talk now.
What do you mean you can't talk now?
Just check out the warehouse and please don't say anything to Bogomil.
Sorry, sir, he's not transmitting anymore.
Shit,
what's the matter?
It's Billy, he's doing something dumb again, but I don't know what. Was he calling from the hotel?
No, sir. Right now his car is heading north on Palm Canyon Road.
Now, this was way before there was satellite tracking of vehicles. We just figured that would be something the Beverly Hills cops could do. Totally made up.
Yes, sir.
Here. You two check that place out, then find me and let me know what the hell is going on over there. And don't talk to anybody but me.
Now, this scene coming up of the assault on the mansion really freaked me out, because I've never really did action scenes before, you know, and the whole idea of shooting and all that kind of stuff is like a total new one on me, and I was very concerned about getting the geography of all of this right, and came out a couple weekends before we shot it and kind of walked the grounds and came up with a structure for the scene in terms of when they're all walking together, how they split up, how they rejoin each other. I just assumed we could get John Ashton on Judge Reinhold's shoulders. I just hoped that would work out. It seemed like it'd be funny.
I'm going inside. You want to stop me? Shoot me.
Me too.
Billy.
Really, Sarge, you can do what you want, but I'm going in with Axel.
God damn it, Billy, this is really serious.
Even
trouble.
Though it's a very simple scene, it kind of intimidated me in a way, because I wasn't really secure about shooting it. So we had very little time to shoot it. And I kept this next little bit, I think, where they're just walking together as a group for this one little area on the other side of this door. I must have shot from a million different angles and a million different ways, because I think I was a little flipped out about moving on to the heart of the scene. And we only use one little shot of the walk. Let's see, is it here or do we... Oh, no, it's right when we cut back to them. This is the set that we made the jail out of, as I was describing earlier on. It was the only way I could get to have a jail set, is if we could just sort of like repaint that and put bars on it. So this shot are all that remain of like a million miles of film covering that little walk, because I think I was a little afraid about moving into the heart of the scene.
Owensby, is Rosewood back yet?
No, sir.
Have you seen Taggart?
Took off about 10 minutes ago.
Foley's on the grounds.
Well, how the hell should I know? We'll get some people out there right away.
Don't take your eyes off that screen.
Location worked out really great. This was supposed to be at night for some reason early on in the script, but night shooting was too expensive. It was kind of the budget was very minimal. And so we had to make it day, and thank goodness, because there's something about all this bougainvillea and the palm trees and the sunny Beverly Hills of it all that kind of really worked well.
Why don't you try to locate Taggart and Rosewood?
I've always loved the way the music kind of changed here. In the middle of sort of an action sequence. I thought it was really kind of a beautiful touch of Harold's. And the way it kind of built. It's going to cut back to them, and it kind of goes back to that little... The way it builds and sort of comically supports their change over to Eddie's M.O. Always seemed kind of delicious.
What's a 20?
...609 Palm Canyon Road.
Who lives at that address?
A Victor Maitland, sir.
What's going on?
This is one of my favorite moments in the movie. The way the music starts to lift, this is really like one of my faves. The way Eddie kind of enjoys them, I love that moment. And I sort of love interrupting it too with this. It was like putting one's foot through the moment with another kind of tension.
You all right?
Oh, man.
What the fuck am I doing here?
You know, it seems almost like, as I watch this, in terms of action movies nowadays, this really does seem almost like something from the silent era. I mean, it seems so primitive by action movie standards.
Good shot, Billy. Let's go.
But it's, you know, it wasn't strictly action. You know, it was sort of like this comedic action, this Laurel and Hardy action. It was sort of an odd hybrid for the time, I guess, you know, it's... It since became like a thing, but the sort of like the idea of combining this kind of humor with this kind of action was kind of new territory.
Cover me.
That little somersault. Eddie had to do part of that. He had to jump off the staircase and land on some cushions, and he wouldn't do it, and I said, look, let me do it. If I can do it, you can do it. And I did it, and he said, all right, I'll do it too. Now, the next stuff in the mansion is a different location, a completely different location. The mansion exterior worked really nice for the exterior, but they wouldn't allow us to step foot in the house, so we had, oh, this is still the exterior. But when we finally head inside, oh, that guy on the right, the machine gunist on the right, who we'll see later on, is the guy who drove the truck in the beginning scene, Gary McLarty, one of the great stunt drivers. This is a different location. And we ran out of money in the budget for set dressing. We had to use the furniture they had in the real place, which was kind of bizarre for an art dealer. I mean, we brought in a couple pieces just to doll it up, but we just didn't have any money for this location anymore. We were kind of at the end of the deal. So this wonderful motif, it would happen accidentally, of Eddie's sneakers, his tennis shoes kind of squeaking, which was sort of, you know, flipped out the sound guys in the beginning of the movie. But then we realized it's sort of like a little nice motif for his character, and it happens a lot throughout the movie. We kind of made a point that we actually put it in places where it wasn't. That machine gunner, that's our driver. Our truck driver, Gary McLarty.
You know what I keep thinking about? You know the end of Butch Cassidy? Redford and Newman are almost out of ammunition. And the whole Bolivian army is out in front of this little hut.
Billy, I'm gonna make you pay for this.
Yeah, all this furniture belonged to the people who owned the house. Except for that vase. Day we shot this, we had a horrendous day. We had to shoot just this van hitting the fountain, not this other stuff, but the van hitting the fountain, and just the van end of it. We not even know the police car end of it. The van hitting the fountain and this gigantic dialogue sequence that's coming up. We had to do all that in one day. We had to spend a half a day on this van hitting the fountain thing. And had no time to shoot the resolution of the movie, which was a scene which I gave Ronnie Cox that morning. And it's got tons of dialogue. You're about to hear it. And it just dazzled everybody's imagination. It just blew our minds that he was able to sort of pull it together and actually do the scene. I think in struggling with some of the dialogue, he actually used that dynamic to help give the scene the feeling that he was making it up as he was going.
Freeze!
There's Gary McLarty.
You're all under arrest! Lay down your weapons in front of you and take two steps back with your hands up!
Very good.
I love these guys. So this scene coming up was, we only had a couple hours to shoot this whole scene, which resolved all the characters. We used every camera that we had on the truck, and we just...
What the hell's going on here?
Thank God that Ronnie Cox was able to pull it off. We just kept moving this barrage of cameras. It was like a firing range of cameras. You know, we just had anybody who can man a camera. And we kind of set up all the cameras on this whole group of actors and shot, then moved them all a little further to the right, shot, kept moving it all around so we can get every possible configuration of close-ups of Eddie, over the shoulders to the chief, over the shoulders back to Ronnie Cox, singles on everybody, group shots, two shots. The whole combination of shots we had to get in practically no time. It was, you know, I was in a panic. I called the studio that during lunch, and I said, you know, we got this really important scene to shoot. We don't have enough time. They said, do the best you can. I was really flipped out, and I was smoking cigarettes at the time, and I smoked around seven packs of cigarettes this day.
Kilos of cocaine. Rosewood immediately called for backup, and I dispatched our officer.
A lot of setups, not just a lot of setups. I mean, again, it's a very simple scene, just close-ups of people. But the thing that was tricky is making sure that there was orchestration of looks for any given moment.
And proceeded to enter the grounds.
A moment when the chief looked at the cop, at Ronnie Cox, the chief looked at various other characters. We had to have the right shots of those characters looking at the chief. We had to have the right shots for Eddie's character looking at John Ashton, et cetera, et cetera. Every combination of a look had to be covered. You know, sort of like a million different combos. And we got it all. We shot a lot of film that day. Because the scene basically came down to... looks and people sort of always being aware of what every other character is up to at any given moment. That's what this one was all about.
Well, I suppose congratulations are in order.
Thank you, sir.
A report better be on my desk in the morning.
Yes, sir. First thing.
You were lying your ass off.
Why don't you go to the hospital and get your shoulder looked at?
Excuse me, sir.
Actually, the idea of Eddie wearing his gun in his back belt like that without a holster or anything was something that we got from Gil Hill, the guy who played his boss. And back in the beginning of the film, back in Detroit, Gil Hill, who was, you know, was a cop, that's how he carried his gun. And it was a similar kind of gun, in fact. You know, Eddie's gun and wardrobe and all of that was, again, based upon the notion that everything he had, you know, was the cheapest, most low-down possible. The only thing he had going for himself was his wits, was the theory. And here's a director with hair. That's the singular worst performance in the movie. My performance as the guy behind the counter.
Guys, y'all didn't have to come down to see me off, but I'm very moved by the gesture. Thank you.
Bogomil ordered us to make sure you got out of town.
You know, it doesn't even matter to me, Billy. You know what matters? That you guys came down here. I'm all choked up on the inside.
Now, just before shooting, also, the last scene in the movie was the previous... scene at the mansion where the whole sort of criminal aspect of the plot was resolved. But it seemed to me that there needed to be a non-plot resolution because of the bonding that occurred between all of these guys here. But that was sort of the real story of the movie, and that needed to really get tied together as well. So this was kind of thrown together at the last minute also.
You saved my life, okay? I don't think I'll ever be able to repay you, but as a token of my appreciation... I want you to have this fine Beverly Palm robe.
Each time you get out of the shower, you're dripping wet for the rest of your life. I want you to think about our friendship. I want you to think about Axel Foley. I love you, Billy.
Thanks, Axel.
Judge is great. Judge is just great. And John, these guys are great.
Billy, take care of the tab, would you?
Hey, Taggart.
Here you are, sir.
This is for you.
No, that's all right. You keep it as a souvenir.
I already have three of them in my bag.
There you go.
Thanks, sir.
Take it easy.
I'm not going to say goodbye.
There comes the dreaded freeze frame. Again, it was a trade-off. Forgive me. But otherwise, I wouldn't have that scene with Victor Maitland and the girl.
Yeah, I sort of figured you would.
Does that mean you guys are going to join me?
I don't think so, Axel. We're still on duty.
I always kind of loathe this freeze frame coming up.
That's right. Listen to Taggart here, Rosewood. Lighten up, all right?
There's actually another very touching little scene here between Eddie and John Ashton that we had to cut out, as I recall, because there's just too many goodbyes.
Don't worry about it. Just follow my lead.
But that's the way it goes. Here comes that freeze frame. Oh, I hate it. I hate it. Oh, well, what can you do?
Chase my train through the polluted air. Birds jump off the pavement. Passion hits the streets. Anger's cooking in the city. So much pressure to be holding on. Hard to get all those time I'm sitting in your